obey the rules of the road. I think what happened down below was the result of a litigator, myself, who's not a patent attorney, versus a patent attorney who is not necessarily a litigator.
Let me ask you about the inequitable conduct. I don't think we have the entire site here, but in Gray, for example, they cite to Mr. Abramson's declaration. And in that declaration, at least one of the reasons that he gave for not disclosing the what was going on in New Zealand were the plaintiffs were specifically told that because the claims of the 881 were allowed and the issuance fee was already paid, there could be no further disclosure considered by the USPTO.
Right.
If that's the so that was at least one of the reasons that Mr. Abramson gave for non-disclosure to the Patent Office. That can't be right, can it? So he's saying it's highly material and I didn't give it to the Patent Office because I was told, presumably by my lawyers, that since the claims were allowed, the issuance fee was already paid, there couldn't be no further disclosure to the PTO. If that's his reason for not disclosing, isn't that problematic for your side?
Well, I think it goes to his, at least arguably to his good faith argument, why it wasn't disclosed.
Well, correct? I mean, as far as you know, I know you said you're not a patent lawyer. Is that correct? So if there's a highly material, probative thing that's going on in New Zealand, he says he didn't give it to them because, he had 2 weeks left and time had run out on him. Is that the way the Patent Office works? That can't be right, right?
Noted, I'm not a patent attorney. However, the patent attorney who was with me on the case.
So you think he was precluded from introducing anything going on?
That was my understanding, that once the patent is issued and the fee paid, the USPTO doesn't want any further submissions to it.
Well, what was the timing? The fee had been paid, but the patent had not been issued. Is that correct?
That's a chronology.
Mr. Abraham's representation about his decision not to disclose the iPod.
Well, I think that's one of his reasons for.
But let's just get to the timing.
In
response to Judge Prost, you just said after the patent issues, they don't want to hear. But I thought that was not the timing issue.
I think the exact chronology is that the patent was approved in December.
Right, approved but not issued yet. Right,
right. They sent the fee notification and the notice of allowance to Flex-Tek International AS's Patent Council. The fee was paid in January.
Right.
Then the patent was issued, I believe, in May.
All right, so the events that we're concerned with occurred prior to issuance, I take it.
The formal issuance and publication, of the patent.
Right.
But the point, in fact, the claims have been allowed and the fee paid. And my understanding from patent counsel who was with me during the trial that if you send in anything to the USPTO, at that point, they'll just send it back to you.
How can that be right? I mean, let's assume you find invalidating prior art. I mean, you're saying that you don't have, not only do you not have an obligation to disclose it to the Patent Office before the patent issues, but you're precluded from disclosing it to the Patent Office before the patent issues?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think you have to consider the exact circumstances that Mr. Abramson is getting this.
But just to answer my question, if the patentee finds invalidating prior art during this interim period, you're suggesting that not only does he not have an obligation to disclose it, but that the Patent Office wouldn't look at it anyway. It's like the Patent Office is going to say, no, too late. You're going to get your patent no matter what you tell us because you've already gone through these other earlier steps.
I have to honestly respond, Your Honor, that I don't know. And I look
for... Doesn't that sound a little odd to you that the Patent Office would refuse to accept information for the patentee that would...
I think if the patentee is moving for a reexamination himself or a continuation, yes, you would submit the new prior art that you had located. However, during this interim period, I look for authority, and patent counsel look for authority on exactly this point, and we could not find anything.
Well, you're the ones that said that they were told, presumably by counsel, that because the patent was allowed, there could be no further disclosure to the patent office. You're the one making this assertion, so presumably you know the ins and outs of why legally you were precluded from
I wasn't patent counsel at the time.
Well, that's not going to carry the day.
I know, but there was separate patent counsel who preceded me. I wasn't aware what they advised him. All I know is what Mr. Abramson told me. And if you consider the circumstances, he's being told this. They abandoned the New Zealand patent, and from his perspective, the New Zealand patent has a different structure than the U.S. patent in that the New Zealand patent had, I believe, 16, 17 different claims, and the longitudinal slots, which are at issue, really the primary issue in this case, were in a dependent claim, not an independent claim, whereas in the U.S., everything was smushed down into one claim at the suggestion of the examiner. So, you know, getting that information, the abandonment of the New Zealand patent, the different structure, and the timing of the payment and allowance, he's being told by patent counsel, look, you don't need to disclose that, and that's what he testified to in his declaration and at the time of trial. So back to what I was talking about earlier, I believe that the district court's rulings should be affirmed per curiam because the appellants here have not identified anything that the court did wrong down below. They followed every step of the procedure. They gave the appellant every possible chance to come forward and make their arguments properly. They just ignored to do so.
You would say, Mr. Long, that even assuming that, I guess your position would have to be that assuming for the moment that the legal advice with respect to what could be submitted to the patent office was incorrect at the time it was given, the fact remains that Mr. Abramson acted in good faith without improper intent.
Right, exactly. And that was what the district court found. They found that the material was material and would have been material to the examiner. What he found, based upon Mr. Abramson testifying in front of him, that he had credibility.
Let me ask you, I think when Mr. Wilson was at the podium, he was asked the question, well, why didn't you, or was suggested he could have come forward with evidence to challenge the veracity of Mr. Abramson's declaration or statements about his intent. And I think Mr. Wilson responded that nobody knew who the lawyer was or where the lawyer was, or do you have any response to that? Have I got it correct what he said?
You got correct what he said, but his statement is absolutely wrong. He had the prosecution history, which has all the submissions from the patent counsel, okay, both for the PCT during the IPONS decision or revocation proceeding, and the United States. He had not one patent counsel. He had three sets of prior counsel, which would appear in that prosecution
the
history.
The word concern was this made by Swedish patent counsel? The statement that you can't submit this, or which of the three counsel, I guess I would say, made the statement that sort of has been the focus of the discussions?
It would have been their local Swedish counsel that served as, I guess, master counsel and pushed out to various jurisdictions for the nationalization of the PCT application was going forward, and everything went back to them, and they advised Mr. Abramson.